Now, just at the end of the hour, we began to speak about Jay, the career of Rodrigo Borgia. It's a very interesting thing in connection with the papacy in the time of the Renaissance. How often a pope would seem to be elected more or less by accident. And then once he was elected, he would give all sorts of honors and opportunities of making money to his relatives. And one of these relatives might eventually become pope, which never would have happened if his uncle had not previously become pope. We do not have any case that I know of where a pope was succeeded by a relative. There was always there were always others in between before he would come to the position. And so there was either real ability or unusual ability to get along with people, perhaps, and not to make enemies, or some particular reason why one of these relatives became pope later. There was always a period of time in between. And of course, that's one of the things that has made for strength in the papacy, that it has been impossible for a pope to control his successor, just as it has been impossible for the cardinals to control a pope for a period of a century and a half about this time. Every time a pope was elected, the cardinals would all promise that any one of them who was elected pope would carry through certain reforms and would give the rest of the cardinals a big voice in what he did, and so on. All sorts of problems were always made, but they were never on any single occasion time. Because every pope, once he became pope, considered himself as absolutely supreme and infallible, and free from any control by anybody else. And they've not always been able to carry that out, because the forces that they meet have often been much too great. Like, take the present pope. It's interesting to read how he feels that he is supreme, and whatever he says is law. But time and again, he seems to have made strong declarations on something, not in perhaps in a papal bull, but in a public speech or something, and then his commissions have talked very strongly the other way, and he has greatly modeled what he said, because he realizes that it's one thing to say a thing, it's another thing to carry it through effectively. But this period here, I thought, would be interesting to survey under the career of one of these men, one who is perhaps better known than any other of the popes of the 15th century. And yet he is not by any means an exception. He may be the most outstanding in certain ways, but there is nothing about Rodrigo Borgia in which he was unique. He was merely perhaps a little more so than the other. And so this Rodrigo Borgia, we notice, is a Spaniard, and he probably never would have been in Italy, never would have even been thought of to be a pope, if it were not for the fact that his uncle, his mother's brother, Calixto III, who was called Alonso Borgia, was elected pope at a time when there were two forces struggling between themselves as to which would become pope, and neither one was quite strong enough, and so they made a compromise, elected an old man of 77, who they thought wouldn't live long, and by that time one or the other of the forces would become strong enough to take over. And this old man happened to be a Spaniard, and his name was Alonso Borgia, and his nephew changed his name to his mother's name, to take the uncle's name. And the uncle welcomed many relatives from Spain and gave them important positions in Italy, and positions in the papacy. And one of those whom he made a cardinal was this nephew, Rodrigo. And Calixto III died in 1458. And Rodrigo did not become pope until, I believe it was 1492. So you see, you have a period of 34 years in which he was an important figure in Italy, had been made important by his uncle's appointment, but in which he could easily have had a failure. He could easily have made a misstep which would have made him lose art altogether. He was not particularly a favorite of most of the leaders in Rome, because most of them were Italians and he was a Spaniard. But during these 34 years, he proved that he was a man of very considerable ability. And he managed to keep friends with whoever was Pope, and keep on his good side, not only that, but to do services for him as a diplomat, which won favor. In addition to that, he had the great advantage of being a tall and handsome man, a very graceful man, a man who was easily made friends, particularly among women. In fact, under the next Pope, Pius II, who was Pope from 1458 to 1464, at one time when Pius II was having a big congress in another city, he found that Cardinal Borgia was seducing so many of the women and having big banquets at which they had lewd dances and that sort of thing, that he publicly rebuked them for his licentiousness, and particularly for his open licentiousness. Because this was fairly early in Rodrigo's career, but fortunately for Rodrigo, he was merely rebuked, and we have no evidence that he made any change whatever in his manner of life as a result of Pius II's rebuke. I guess I should have some subheads under this, Jay. So let's call one his uncle. That deals with how he became cardinal, Callistus III. His uncle, Callistus III, and I'll mention his date for you, 1455 to 1458. And then number two, we'll mention the next Pope, Pius II. 1458 to 1464. Pius II, his birth name was Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini. And he had often been gone by his first two names, Aeneas Silvius. He was a man who had many different attitudes in life. He was an able writer, an able secretary, and he had been at the Council of Basel and had written some of his strongest declarations of the authority of a council and its supremacy over a pope who was simply an executive officer under the council. But then when Pius saw that the Council of Basel was, as Aeneas Silvius he was then, when he saw that the Council of Basel was losing out, he managed to get a position as secretary to the emperor, secretary and court lawyer at the court of the emperor. He served under the emperor for a time and found that the emperor and Pope Eugene IV were rather at loggerheads, and that Eugene IV was apt to win out, and he managed to switch positions and become secretary to Eugene IV. And thus he got into the Vatican group, and at the death of Callistus III, when again the leading factions, no one of them was able to elect a pope, they elected him. He was now a bit long in years and a bit weakened in many ways, but he made a vigorous pope, and he issued a declaration that no council had authority over any pope, that popes were superior over all councils, past, present, or future. And when somebody said, why, they said, when you were secretary at the Council of Basel, you made declarations just the opposite of it. Well, he said, forget everything Aeneas ever did, pay attention to what Pius does. And he was one of these men who is able to switch sides and to win, take over the winning side. And during his reign, he strongly reprimanded Rodrigo for living The way that Pius himself had formerly lived, though not as extremely so as Rodrigo did, but Rodrigo was not in any way removed, simply reprimanded. And then the next pope reigned for 7 years, and during his reign, Rodrigo was able to take positions of importance and to represent him on various diplomatic missions. And we skip on to the second pope after Pius II, who is called Sixtus IV. Sixtus IV. He was pope from 1471 to 1484. He was a general of the Franciscans, but he belonged to a family of middle standing, the family called Della Rovere. And again, the same thing happened as had happened with Calixtus III. He appointed many relatives to positions of importance, and one relative whom he appointed bided his time and worked to get ahead and eventually became Rodrigo Borgia's greatest adversary, the nephew of this pope, Sixtus IV. Sixtus IV, during the 13 years that he was pope, was a very energetic pope, and he set to work to beautify Rome, to continue the building up of great buildings and the making of it a great metropolitan center, as all the popes had been doing since Martin V. And also, he proceeded to try to strengthen the papal hold on central Italy, which was called the Papal State. We have noticed how popes earlier tried to exert their authority over all the crowned heads of Europe. They still were doing considerable of that at this time, but they realized the importance of a strong home base, and it was a difficult thing to get complete control of the so-called papal state, the central portion of Italy. And so Sixtus IV mixed considerably in local Italian politics. In this connection, situation that brought everlasting disgrace to his name was the fact that in his controversy with the city of Florence, that city in Italy which has probably produced more great men than any other city in the world's history, at least more famous men, in his controversy with Florence, he determined, or at least his associates determined, to put an end to the control of the very able leader of Florence, Lorenzo de' Medici, and his brother. And a plot was made. And one day, right in the middle of a church service, right at the most sacred part, according to their viewpoint, of the service, two priests suddenly stabbed Lorenzo and his brother. The brother of Lorenzo died from the attack. Lorenzo managed to survive. Now, McSorley tries to make out that he says Sixtus made himself a party to a conspiracy, which affected not a revolution as the Pope intended, but the assassination of Lorenzo's brother. There is no evidence, however, to show that the Pope knew of the intended murder. He was the ringleader in it all. He helped to plan it, but whether he thought they would dispose of him in some way without actually killing them, unless you were on the ground with a tape before you became proof. But everybody at the time felt that Sixtus IV was very deeply implicated in this plot which killed Lorenzo's brother and which nearly killed Lorenzo de' Medici. Now, Lorenzo de' Medici and his brother, who is still at this time, have a definite interest in church history because each of them had a son who became pope later on. And in fact, these two sons were popes right in the most crucial time of the Reformation. And so their activities and their attitudes become tremendously important for us next fall. But the two sons were, one was at this time a small boy, and the other was not yet born when his father was killed. In fact, I don't believe his father was yet married to his mother when he died. But, so that put a problem on the boy's early life, but that was overcome, and he eventually did become poor. Sixthly, is well remembered for another thing. Everybody who ever goes to Rome as a tourist knows that among the most important sites in Rome that he would like to see is the Sistine Chapel, the place where all popes are elected and have been for some centuries, and the place where Michelangelo's most famous paintings adorn the ceiling and one end of the room, and paintings by other famous artists adorn the two sides of the room. That Sistine Chapel was built by Sixtus IV and is named after him. Actually, all that he did was to build the building, a very high, rectangular building, an awkward thing, actually. It's right next to St. Peter's, and right on the edge between St. Peter's and the Vatican. It's considered part of the Vatican. But it is an awkwardly built thing, and it is the great genius of Michelangelo that he was able to take this awkwardly built building and to plan his paintings in such a way that he makes the structure of it a part of the beauty which he built into it. There are probably no more famous paintings in the world than Michelangelo's Last Supper, built 70 years later at one end of the building, and here's some paintings of the creation on the ceiling, which are so high up, Michelangelo had to climb up them for a year and a half. He had to lie on his back on a high scaffold painting these, and then climb down about 50 feet every time in order to see what it looked like from below. And you go there now, in midsummer, any time, and you find 1,000 people in the place looking up at the top and trying to see those wonderful paintings 60 feet above them up there on the field. They are indeed among the world's most outstanding paintings, but Sixtus IV doesn't deserve credit for that, though it was his nephew who commissioned Michelangelo to do it. And Michelangelo was a very different character from these folks. We will see part of the reason for his difference a little later. But that comes a few decades after the time at which we're now looking. Now, Sixtus IV died in 1484. And by this time, the nephew of Sixtus IV was very hopeful he might become elected pope. But Rodrigo Borgia, who for 30 years had been active in papal affairs, was hopeful he might be elected pope. And each of them began making gifts to various cardinals and trying to secure their support. And Mazzoli says one of these men arrived at the head of an army, and the possibility of a schism was openly discussed. But the cardinals all agreed that whoever was elected would not rule absolutely, but he would let the various cardinals rule together with him, Mazzoli says. They made an election agreement, the effect of which would be to transform the church into an oligarchy. But they did that repeatedly, and then they paid no attention to it, the man who was elected. And he says, neither Rodrigo Borgia nor his chief opponent, Cardinal Della Rovere, could obtain the requisite 2/3. And Mazzoli says, Della Rovere solved the problem by using persuasion and bribery to secure the election of his protege, Cardinal Cibo, the idea. Here is Mazzoli in this Roman Catholic history of the church who makes this statement. Della Rovere solved the problem by using persuasion and bribery to secure the election of his protege. But he says the new pope, a widower with 3 children, had neither the spiritual vision nor the courage to discharge the duties of his high office. And for a variety of motives, he nominated unfit men as cardinals, including the 13-year-old son of Lorenzo de' Medici. And Mazzoli says the majority of the cardinals at this time were worldly and a number of them were openly dissolute, notably Rodrigo Borgia, richest and noblest of them all. One of the most corrupt and wicked men in the whole city of Rome was the Pope's own son, Francis Cetro Sebo. And so during the years, we'll make that number four innocent third, 1484 to 1492. During these 80 years, things were even worse than they had been in the... Pardon? No, innocent eight. I forgot the V at the beginning. Innocent eight. Innocent third, you all know, was 200 years old, 250 years old. But under innocent eight, conditions were perhaps even worse than they had been under the wicked 64th, because innocent eight was an old and feeble man who rather allowed the forces around him to proceed as they were inclined, so long as his relatives could get sufficient advantage out of the whole situation. And so during these 8 years, things rather went from bad to worse, and finally, Innocent VIII died, and now Rodrigo Borgia, the nephew of Sixtus IV, the nephew of Calixtus III, and Cardinal della Rovere, the nephew of Sixtus IV, each of them felt that his time had come. You remember that I read to you that Mussolini said that when Innocent VIII was elected, that Rovere had been spending much money in bribes and so on. Well, when Rodrigo Borgia was able to make bigger bribes than he could, and to become elected, he went off in disgust and went around Europe trying to persuade every king that he should refuse to recognize him as Pope because he'd won his papacy by bribery. But that takes us to number five, Alexander VI. And Alexander VI, who was Pope from 1492 to 1503, was Rodrigo Borgia. It is usually thought that he spent a great deal of money. Mussolini says Rodrigo Borgia was reported to be distributing lavish bribes. There is no doubt that he gave his palace to one of the cardinals, his very fine palace, and he seems to give him many things to various cardinals. Mussolini says he was a handsome man of imposing figure, mentally alert, a cardinal deacon since his 25th year, and matured by diplomatic experience in Spain and Italy. He might have seemed eminently fitted for the papal throne, had it not been that his moral disqualifications, as Mussolini says, were grave and notorious, and that he had continued his evil life after receiving a rebuke from Pius II in 1460. And so you have here a strong Pope, an able man, but a man who is recognized everywhere as being one of the most wicked men to be found in the world at the time. And also a man who is more interested in his own family than in anything else. And he had a large family. There was one woman, the wife of another man, who had been his mistress for over 20 years. And he had had five children by her, to whom he was tremendously devoted. And he made no secret whatever the fact that they were his children. But a few years before he became Pope, he tired of her, and he took a new mistress, a young woman, sister of one of the leaders of Rome. And she lived with him, right with him, in the Vatican. But the other woman occasionally came to see the son, one daughter and the son. And the name Borgia has passed into popular stories as a symbol, and not so much for immorality as for murder, for poison, for trickery of every kind. I don't know this so much today, but 40 years ago, books of Teacher of the Borgias and this Danger of the Borgias and that sort of thing, they were common novels because he became a figure that seized the imagination of people liking to write that sort of book. And there were many stories of people, enemies, having been invited to dinner and poisons and that sort of thing. There's no way to prove how much truth there was to any of them. But he gave his sons important positions in the church, and he was able to marry his daughter to a prominent Roman official, and then when he had a chance to marry her to a more prominent Italian duke, the one she was married to was murdered in the street, and they had a beautiful wedding to the new one. In fact, when Rodrigo was made pope, they say the ceremonies were the most imposing Rome had ever seen, with the great amount of display and the great amount spent on the very fine ceremonies as he became the pope. But Sorey says, Alexander lived in a chronic state of alarm over the possibility of a conciliary investigation of the charge that his election had been simoniac, another way of saying it, had been the result of bribery, and therefore invalid. And the threat to summon a council became a stock procedure. Another recurrent theme came from the satirical poems and venomous epigrams which lampoon the Borgia. He was, however, an able ruler, and he set himself to get greater control over the papal church. And he appointed his son, the Duke of Gandia, as head of the armies and in charge of the papal political activities to get complete control of the papal state. And one night, late at night, his son was murdered right at the front of the Vatican. And the next morning, his body was fished out of the cupboard. According to popular story, it was the brother, Caesar Borgia, who was responsible for it. There was never any proof that he was. But Alexander III was very, very much hurt by this, and he issued a statement saying, "We have been sinful, we have been wicked, God has punished us for our sins, we are going to reform, we are going to reform the church." It was a great statement of penitence and confession and desire to make a change. But unfortunately, within a few weeks, the effect wore off, and he devoted himself instead to making Caesar great, his second son, who was generally thought to have been responsible for the death of the older brother. They found a fisherman who said that he had seen a cart drive up to the edge of the Tiber and a body thrown from it into the Tiber the night before at 2 o'clock. They found him a week later. And they said to him, "Well, why didn't you report this?" "Oh," he says, "I see hundreds of such things." He said, "Why should I report one of them?" It gives an idea of how generally unsafe life was in Rome at this time. Money was flowing in from all over Europe. There was one man recognized as Pope. The prestige of the papacy was as high as it had ever been in history. And these popes, all of them, were very adept at finding new ways of receiving funds. Whenever a bishop died, his successor usually had to pay his whole first year's income to the Pope in order to become appointed. And the same was true of dozens of positions throughout the church. They found all kinds of ways of bringing in great sums of money. But Caesar Borgia, the son, became very well known for the great skill which he inherited from his father. He was a skillful man and an able man. And he set to work to win control over the papal state by any possible way that he could. And he would make friends with people, and then when he had them in his power, there was one case when there were three large groups of mercenary soldiers that had revolted against him, And he made peace with them and made an agreement, giving them everything they had demanded. And they had a big dinner to celebrate. And then after the dinner, he sat in convivial chat with the three leaders in three groups until their men mostly got tired and gradually drifted away to bed. But the three leaders were embarrassed to leave the commander-in-chief before he himself would give the signal. And so finally there was only himself and the three leaders in the room. And then at a signal from him, men stepped quietly, came up from behind and put a rope around the neck of each of the three and sprang with them there. And thus did away with the leaders, and the men without their leadership found it best to submit and to become his faithful mercenaries. And this story was abundantly given and well known throughout Italy. Now there was at this time a man in Italy whose name has become a widely known name, but a man who of very peculiar character named Machiavelli, Niccolo Machiavelli, M-A-C-C-H-I-A-V-E-L-L-I, Machiavelli. Machiavelli was a petty official in Florence, and he was sent from the city of Florence to Rome as a representative, and there he saw what Caesar Borgia was doing, and he saw how effective, how successful Caesar Borgia was. Now, there is much disagreement and uncertainty as to the character of Machiavelli. Some think of him as a very wicked man, some think of him as a very good man. It is impossible to prove his character. But it would seem that Machiavelli was greatly interested in the welfare of Italy. And he saw Italy torn into tiny factions, fighting against each other all the time. City after city was conquered by other cities and was plundered, and then eventually might regain its strength and it might plunder the other cities. And there was this constant fighting between the different cities of Italy. And Machiavelli was anxious that Italy become united and free from this sort of attack. Florence for a time was a republic, and Machiavelli had a fairly good position in it. He went as representative of it to Rome. He was with Caesar Borgia when these three men were killed. He accompanied Borgia's army as a representative of Florence. And then the Medici family, which had controlled Florence, but which had been driven out of Florence, again, one of their lesser members gained control and became the prince of Florence and had control of the city for a time. Machiavelli was out of office, but Machiavelli, according to the view of those who were most friendly towards him, pondered over the situation and said, if only somebody like Caesar Borgia would overcome these different fighting factions in Italy and would unite them into one body under one control, there would be peace in Italy and a chance for ordinary people to go about their business and to develop and for their country to go ahead, and then maybe they could get rid of the tyrants in time. But a tyrant who would get control would be far better than this situation with all these little separate groups fighting against each other all the time. And so Machiavelli, whether that is the reason, we don't know. But a good argument can be made for it. At any rate, he was out of office now. And he studied the ancient Greek and Roman writings extensively. And he wrote a book. He wrote a book called The Prince. And in this book, The Prince, he took what he had observed from observing Caesar Borgia, plus other thoughts of his own, and gave advice as to how a prince might become supreme. And he had many very clever ideas. One, for instance, was this. If you have bitter enemies whom you fight and whom you defeat, when you have defeated them, take one of two choices. Forgive them completely, be entirely friendly, Bind them to yourself by friendship and by joining them with you and giving them great honor. Or else, kill them and get completely rid of them. Do not take any half measure. A half measure results in an enemy that will make more trouble later on. Whereas either of these extreme attitudes, properly carried out, may be successful. Now that's just one of the many practical ideas he works out as to how a prince could get absolute control over a large area. And many of them were taken from observing the skillful activities of Caesar Borgia. Machiavelli wrote, finished his book, printed it up in nice, bound it up in a nice binding, had it very nicely pictured, and dedicated it to the Medici, the minor Medici figure who was now the nominal ruler of Florence. And he sent it to him. And when this petty princeling received this book called The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli, he said, how nice of this fellow. He used to be an official in the Republic to make me a present of a book he's written. Send him a cask of wine as a sign of my gratitude. And he stuck the book on the shelf and never looked at it. And a few years later, there was a revolution in Florence. And this man was defeated and driven out of the city. Florence again was made a republic. And Machiavelli said, again I will become secretary of the republic. I will again have a chance to use my ability in advancing Florence. But the people who had driven the prince out had come across a book in his library written by Machiavelli telling him how to become supreme. And so they took the book and they said, what kind of a man is this Machiavelli giving our tyrant advice on how to destroy us? And so though Machiavelli waited hopefully day after day for notice that he'd given an important position in the government, he received none. And he found the leaders of the government considered him a traitor and were dead against him. And he felt so discouraged that he simply died of a broken heart. And so that was the end of Machiavelli. But his book has been copied and recopied. It appears in the Modern Library series, the Napoleon, and most of the great conquerors of history since his time have had his books for their bedside companions. And the name Machiavelli has become a common adjective for clever, ruthless figurines on how to get ahead regardless of the welfare of anybody else. Now, whether that was really Machiavelli's attitude or not, we don't know. It may have been, it may not, but the greater part of what he describes is based on the life of Caesar Borgia. And it was Caesar Borgia from whom he got the great bulk of these ideas. In his book, The Prince, which has been probably one of the five most influential books in history since his time, because of so many prominent leaders in all countries of the world who have received ideas from Machiavelli's very clever book. Now, how many of these ideas were his and how many he derived from Caesar Borgia, we don't know. But Borgia managed to conquer most of the sections of central Italy, to get them under his control, often very cruelly. Many murders of the leaders occurred. There were all sorts of his things that he was involved in, that the morality of which nobody had defended. And his younger sister, Lucretia, as he said, was married to two different officials, one after another, and each time the official was done away with. Finally, they married her to the prominent duke of a section in northern Italy when he was still only 21. And Lucretius Borgia's name has become connected with a popular fancy with a very wicked woman, though most scholars feel that in her case it was not justified. Because as far as evidence goes, after she finally married this man in northern Italy, she became a very estimable woman and lived there as the countess of this section of northern Italy for many years. But eventually, Alexander VI and Caesar Borgia were suddenly taken ill with a fever. And when they were taken ill with a fever, which is usually thought to have been malaria, we of course can't be sure now at this distance exactly what it was, but they were both sick with the fever. Alexander VI died. And Caesar Borgia, with his great funds and his skill, might have become the next pope, or might have been able to control who would be the next pope. But he was sick with a fever, unable to do much, and the result was that somebody who was an enemy of his became pope. And eventually he went back to Spain and there died in a petty spring. But at least that as long as they were divided up into little petty regions fighting, there was no safety for anybody. Some think that, while others think that he simply was interested in clever dealing and how to get ahead, and he didn't have a chance to do much of it himself, and so he wrote up how somebody else could do it. We have no way of proving by the church. He did at one time, a little after the time of Rodrigo Borgia, he wrote a musical comedy, which was evidently good enough that it was acted at the papal court in Rome. And I've seen it published in a book of famous plays within the last year. I've seen it on the newsstand, Machiavelli's Mondo Gold. So he was a man of great ability and of wide reading. And his book has had great influence because it has given clever ideas to a great many people in very prominent positions since. But many of the ideas came from Caesar Borgia, whose life sputtered out in a minor skirmish in Spain after he lost his tent, doing anything in Rome, because of his misfortune in having a fever at the time that his father died. We will have a bit more to say about Alexander VI later on. But I think we should notice specifically here the Italian Renaissance. The Italian Renaissance. Now the word Renaissance is an interesting word. R-E-N-A-I-S-S-A-N-C-E. It is a French word which means rebirth. It means rebirth, and it is applied to all fields of activity. But it perhaps refers more than any other to the field of art. And the Renaissance in Italy, which began about the middle or earlier of this 15th century and running until the middle nearly of the next century, was a period in which Italian art reached a height which has never even been approximated by any other section anywhere in the world. You will find people today who will run it down and who will laugh at Raphael and Michelangelo, they're old, they're out fashioned and out of date, and think of some reason and question his painting, and they like his paintings better, maybe so. But if a painting by one of these men were to come on the market, it probably would sell for 10 times what any painting by any modern painter will sell for. Wherever they are very closely kept, because their value is universally recognized. Now this Renaissance actually isn't a term simply applied to painting. It is applied to the fact that the people who for 1,000 years had been struggling to get a living, to get a better living from the source, and who had been in danger all their lives, if they became at all from most of the Dark Ages, and who had been able, most of whom had been quite illiterate, so that gradually decreased in these latter years. That among them, at this time, there came a flowering of all sorts of abilities. And one thing that stimulated these abilities was the very divisions in Italy. In Italy, there were these terrible fightings and destructions of different places that I've mentioned. But in Italy, Italy would never become a country because of the fact that you had the Pope of Italy and the German Emperor, each of whom came to be control over both countries. And the result was that there was constant fighting back and forth for many centuries. And so the local dukes held their own territory. There were a few small republics, but most of it was dukedom who were holding their local territories. And in this period, they began to vie with each other, not merely in fighting, though they did plenty of that, but in seeing who could build the most beautiful place. Who could make such a headquarters that everybody else in the kingdom would be astonished and say, how marvelous this was. Now, it may be possible that today there are artists in the world just as great as Perugino and Raphael and Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci and these others, and they do. There's no way of knowing. But in those days, every one of these dukes was looking for people to build buildings for him and to make them attractive, to paint things in them. And every little church was anxious to have beautiful paintings in it. And the result was anybody in the area who could paint at all had a chance to try his ability. There were rewards for it that stimulated individuals. And the result of all this stimulation was that those who might have such ability, who in ordinary times perhaps would be busy working in some other line and never do anything in it except as a hobby, found it to their advantage to try the best they could to develop whatever ability they had. And so in Italy, during this period of the Renaissance, there flowered ability, particularly in the aesthetic line, such as the world has never seen. There have been occasional great outstanding men in these lines, though I don't know of any one of them who I think compares with these great Italian leaders of this time. But certainly there's never been a group of them at all comparable to the large group of men in Italy who were making outstanding artistic work during this period. And, of course, these different dukes vying for each other, it all centered up in the Vatican, where from the time of Nicholas I, early in the century, right on to the middle of the next century, you had popes who were anxious that their court should be the finest in Italy. And so, though the bulk of the great artists came from Florence or Venice, practically all of them were at one time or another hired to go to Rome and to work in Rome, and to do what they could to help in the beautifying of the city of Rome. And Nicholas I started that, but all of these popes continued it to quite an extent and reached its flowering in the beginning of the next century. Now, the place where I'm most familiar with, of course, is in painting. I can think of nothing I enjoy better than having a day in Rome last fall. I got to Rome one night, had a good night's sleep, and got up early in the morning and rushed to get to St. Peter's at before nine in the morning, when the gallery opened. The Vatican had that next St. Peter's. And at nine, I entered in here with all these beautiful paintings, and I walked quick past them. Walked as fast as I could, about half a mile, clear through the hunk of it, till I got to the 15th Chapel. And getting to the 15th Chapel there, right at nine in the morning, you have that wonderful painting of the Last Supper by Michelangelo at the end, and you have all these marvelous paintings at the top, and you have maybe 15 people in the room. And you sit there and you look at it, and you take in these paintings by others around, wonderful things and these things, and you look at all the marvelous detail of it. But by 20 minutes later, there may be 800 people in the room, and it's just a gap. And ordinarily, if you go there, it's very difficult to see. But if you rush and get there very first thing, you have a few minutes without much distraction. And then you want to look at Raphael's pictures, Raphael's marvelous sconces, which are halfway between, but by that time, they have put up signs you have to go in a certain direction. And that they're in the wrong direction, so you have to clear back it, start again, go around. And you get to Raphael's paintings, which are just as fine as Michelangelo's, fully. And I spent half a day there sitting, looking at his great paintings in his room with a signature, where you sit there for 3 minutes and you see them, and there may be 20 people in the room. That's a small room. And then all of a sudden, here comes a group of 60 people with somebody loudly explaining everything for 15 minutes. In English, and then they pass off. Then you have 2 minutes to look at them, and then there comes a group of 60 or somebody in French explaining it all, and the next will be German, and the next will be Italian, and so it goes. And most of them spend 2 or 3 minutes, and I think they've seen the very greatest painting in that you find anywhere in the world, which are there on the walls of this room of the signature, which is only one of the many rooms in the Vatican. And in the Vatican there is a section which is only open certain days a week, which is called the Borgia apartment. And there you find the apartments that Alexander the VI worked at. And there you have some little maps of what was known as the New World. Because the very year when he became Pope was the year when Columbus discovered America. And the Portuguese went south around the Cape of Good Hope and went to the east. And the Spanish went west, and they discovered Central America and the northern part of South America, and went over down into Peru. And some of the Portuguese hit a region rather far west, which was a long way east of where the Spanish were. And so they said, we don't want to fight over what we get. Let's go to the Pope and ask him to divide. So they went to Pope Alexander VI. And so the Borgia Pope drew a line on the map. And he said, this side of this is Portuguese, and this side is Spanish. And the result is that half of South America today speaks Portuguese, and the other half speaks Spanish, because Alexander Borgia drew the line and determined what was to be the Spanish area and what was to be the Portuguese area. And so you have about 5 big rooms there, which are the Borgia apartments, which you can see today, but which have nothing outstanding in them, but interesting mementos of that period. When America had just been discovered. Well, we continue there a week from next Tuesday.